It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 5.4.
Wishing that swashbuckling would become a respectable career option again so that we could be just like the Grey Friar.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
We have with us today Clay and Susan Griffith, authors of Vampire Empire, book one, The Grey Friar, and of course many other books to follow, which we'll hopefully talk about a little bit. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So let's start first up, which is the big, easy, simple starter stock question, which is tell us a bit about how you both got into writing and particularly why fantasy instead of, like, I don't know, like knitting books.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll go first then. Basically, we met at a bookstore, surprisingly, and we were, I was buying comic books at the time because we were both into comics, and we've generated that love all the way through our career. We wound up, he broke into comics first, and we were very, I was, you know, helpful and excited for him, and was still working on my own stuff. And then finally he got a contract with Disney, and well, not with Disney, it was Acclaim Comics, basically, who had bought the Disney license. And he quickly agreed to write for them without realizing he knew very little about Disney. So he asked me, if since I was a Disney aficionado, to come on board. And so we wrote together for the first time doing those. But so we wound up working together on the Acclaim stuff for Disney, and it worked so well that we decided to keep going. And we just started doing straight from comics to short stories, and then made the eventual leap into novels, and we've really never looked back. We both have a lot of the same likes, and as you can see just by us getting to know each other from comic books, just buying a comic book together at a bookstore, it was a match made in heaven. So we both wound up liking the same genres, both steampunk, fantasy, the old pulp novels, all those old kind of horror basics. Were both things we loved, so it just became a natural course for us to work together on these things.
Yeah, we have, as she said, we have the same interest. We grew up with the same types of interest, old movies, adventure stories, pulp. We read fantasy. We've read many of the same books. So it's just a natural transition to want to write the kinds of stories that you grew up enjoying. I like mystery detective stories. Susan particularly is a fan of westerns, but fantasy and historical adventure just were more in our blood, so we went in that direction.
So, I mean, obviously this is kind of probably a popular question asked of you guys, and of all couples that somehow make a both a marriage and a working relationship work. So what is the trick to writing collaboratively in a collaborative process together? What's the process?
The process, we'll do two ways. I'll tell you what the trick is, and then Susan can tell you what the process is. The trick, I think, anyway, is patience. That's the trick to any kind of writing, but you have to be patient. You have to listen to what the other person says, because writing in and of itself is a very solitary sort of endeavor, and you're inside your head a lot. But when you're collaborating, you're inside other people's heads too, and they bring their own ideas which may be better than yours. You just may not want to admit it at first. So you have to be committed to the project as a whole, and you have to completely trust the other person you're working with that they will bring A, good ideas, or you won't be working with them in the first place, and B, that they know what they're talking about and that they're not there just to make their stuff look good and your stuff look bad, so it ends up being their book rather than both of your books. So all those things going together, that's also, fortunately, what goes into making up a marriage or a relationship of any kind. So it's not easy. It doesn't always work. But if you work at it enough, you end up with a pretty good product at the end of it, and it's better, I believe, it's a better product than what you would have had by yourself. So that's what I'm proudest of when I look at the stuff we've done together. I know that Greyfriar is a better book by Clay and Susan Griffith than it would have been by Clay Griffith or by Susan Griffith alone. So now let Susan kind of tell you what the procedure is.
And the process is based on that as well. I mean, we both bring certain elements to the table. We have each have our strengths and our weaknesses, and we make sure that we can trust the other person to take on that aspect of us that we're not as strong in. Clay is strength is world building, and mine is action adventure and a little bit of the romance. And so when one of the chapters, when something calls for that in the writing, we'll kind of divvy the chapters up that way. But what basically starts is a very big process of trying to build the world and talk about the ideas, and we break it down together and create the world and then separate it into a chapter outline so we know what will happen in each chapter. And after that, and that's a very collaborative process. And then after that, it becomes solitary again, with each of us divvying up the chapters. And again, based on our strengths and weaknesses, and we sort of separate for a while. But then we start swapping the chapters back and forth. Once they're finished, we start swapping back and forth. And so we let the other person have free reign over those chapters. And by that extension, they're changed dramatically. Constantly, and then they come back to me and I'll do it again, and then they go back to him and he does it again. So at some point, both our voices sort of disappear and we boil it down into a single voice, and it's that voice that comes out in these books. It's neither Clay Griffith nor Susan Griffith, but this amalgamation of both of us. That's basically how the process works.
It's the Sue Clay Griffith or the Clusen.
Do not come up the Clusen.
Exactly.
So, well, this is actually really interesting, and I liked how there's a little dig at Clay about how you're better at romance than he is.
No, it's not a dig, actually. It's quite accurate. It's not that she's better at romance, because, in fact, in my defense, many of the sort of romantic moments in the book that people commented on in the reviews were in the very first premise that I wrote up.
But, that is true.
But if I had executed them, they simply wouldn't have been as strong or as good. I didn't know how to make the characters earn that emotional resonance that the readers felt. I knew what needed to be there, but I didn't know how to create the relationship long term. It's kind of a guy thing, it's women understand long-term relationship and little moments that go into building a relationship. Guys understand big dramatic gestures, but they don't know that they need to do the little things every day as you go along. And that's, why it works, the two of us.
I just have to say that I'm going to make my husband listen to that.
There's no guarantee any male will listen and understand the process. Luckily, Clay has been great about that. I mean, Clay is very much a gentleman, and he understands that when I come in and gripe about something, like, he'll, in all defense, of course, we have our arguments, and there will be those moments where Clay stands up and goes, no, that's not the way it happens. And then we sort of just have to constantly have to say, yeah, this is what's needed. We need this little tweak here. We need this little bit here in order to make that moment resonate. But it's a lot, like he says, it's patience and trust and understanding. And at first, you're not going to get there right off the bat, but gradually, you know, if you can work it right, it's a success.
So, interesting.
So since clearly Jen and I have amazing chemistry together.
Amazing.
Should we, despite not being married, should we become like writing buddies?
I think anybody can, as long as you have the patience, the willpower, and the desire to produce a product that you're both going to be proud of. Like Clay says, it's patience and it's trust. You have to trust that person to leave the ego at the door and concentrate solely on creating a not just a product, but a relationship, a collaboration, a collaborative effort. If you can't, you know, if you're going to hold everything close to the chest and go, no, that's mine, and you can't delete that character, you can't delete that moment, things like make it very tough. You have to have that thick skin and that ability to trust your partner going, all right, I guess he's right.
Well, then we're screwed. Giant.
You know,
ego.
Actually, being married helps the collaborative process, because if you're just friends or you're just collaborators, if you get into a huge argument over something, it's very easy, I think, to just say, ah, screw it, I'll go off and do it myself. You know, if I'm not going to get to write the book that I want to write, why am I bothering? But if you're married, once you've made the commitment, as we have for many years, to write together, you can't say, oh, screw it, I'm going to go off and write the book I want to write, because we now are a brand, you know, we're married and we're a writing brand. So if we go off and write the books we're going to write, we're not going to be married anymore either. So that creates a huge impetus to stay together and continue to work through these problems, which we always have. And that sort of power isn't there in just a friendship or a pure collaboration where you can easily walk away without having to call attorneys in.
Yeah, I still have to see him over dinner, over at the dinner table, and I'll always remember, oh, you're the one that dropped the book, you know. So it's not going to happen that easily if you're, you know, when you're married.
Gotcha.
So what I'm hearing is writing saves marriages.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it saved it. We'd probably still be married anyway, but it certainly enriches the marriage, gives us something to talk about constantly. The day doesn't go by where we're not going over plots and changing, unfortunately, changing plots constantly and characters. But it gives you something to talk about. It gives you a project to work on together. It gives you, hopefully, if you're published, a thing at the end of it that you can be proud of that you've put together, like a kid or whatever. And it's certainly enriched our marriage an enormous amount, just like our marriage has enriched the writing. So it works both ways.
I can never write with my husband, but maybe I can write with Sean someday.
It basically boils down to the partner you're choosing. You have to choose your collaborative person, partner, extremely well. If you both like the same things and you both have similar voices and you have these great ideas and you like each other's ideas, that's a good collaboration. It's usually when you have opposing ideas and you're not willing to make those changes, that's a bad collaboration. So sometimes friendships are just as a marketable collaborative thing as a marriage. I mean, we were just lucky that we both loved almost everything exactly the same in terms of our writing preferences. So that helped a lot. We both have the same loves. We both have the same passions. And so that was easy to, you know, to join this collaboration.
Cool. Okay, so let's get to the actual books themselves. The world of the Vampire Empire is alternate history, steampunk adventure, political thriller, urban fantasy, and romance, and obviously a vampire novel. What was the motivation for weaving all of these elements together? I mean, you've talked a little bit about these are kind of things, some of these elements at least are things that you guys were passionate about beforehand, but why bring them all together in one series?
I don't think we consciously did that. Since the book's been out, we've been either accused or praised of smashing genres together, which is great. But when we set out to write this book, we didn't think, okay, you know, I like this, I like this, I like this. Let's put them all together. We just liked all those things, so we wrote a novel that included elements that turned out to involve various genres. I always kind of liken it to an old movie. We're both old movie buffs, but if you think of a great classic adventure film from the 30s or 40s, those things are very genre blending. They had a little bit of something for everybody. They'd have a little romance, they'd have a little comedy, they'd have a little action, they might have some horror elements to it, a thriller, they might have a music. We can't, you know, obviously put a dance number in the book, but old movies operated that way. And that's just how we approached it. We just wrote the novel we wanted, and it turned out that it smashed all these genres, which had been separated out by the publishing industry for many decades, smashed them back together, and seems to have gotten a lot of attention for that.
And in truth, mixing genres has been around within the last couple of years. I mean, we see a lot of that happening now. And I think, again, it's just because there's been a change in the marketing industry. Before, they had boxed us up, only romance and romance area, only thrillers and mystery area, and only sci-fi fantasy and sci-fi fantasy area. But you're starting to see this blending already. I mean, there's plenty of authors out there right now that are playing with that. Paranormal romance is a big one. It's still in the fantasy section, but it's a cult with romance in it. So you're seeing this slow shift back towards getting out of the boxes and putting the genres and blending them a little bit more. So ours was just taking it to the nth level, and instead of just blending two genres, we've decided to throw in, you know, four or five. And so far it has worked, thankfully.
Yeah, we've actually found that with a number of the authors that we've recently interviewed, is that, I mean, for sure, I'm seeing it more in what I've been reading in the past year or two of the, not necessarily disparate, but very varied genres in a lot of what I've been reading. And I've appreciated that facet of kind of the newer style of genre. Yeah. Because when you are stuck in those, you know, individual genres, you, over time, I think many of the books have started becoming a little bit more locked in and beholden to the tropes of the specific genres.
Yeah, I don't know how far I would want to push this next thought, but I think it may have something to do with women. Coming in the last decade or in the last decade or two to dominate the fantasy and increasingly science fiction world, the way they took over the mystery thriller world back in the 70s and 80s, men, when they wrote science fiction fantasy, didn't necessarily care about a relationship story except in the most basic way. But women, and this is something Susan has taught me, you know, they would grow up sort of being shoved into gothics or romance, but as Susan has often said, she gravitated towards boys' books if she could get them because she wanted action adventure, and when she could find a romantic story that was still primarily an action-adventure story, she'd take it. And I think it's the fact that women are now writing and editing and agenting, much probably more so than men, and also women are the majority of readers in America. And I think that has a lot to do with creating this genre blending. It's because that's what the audience and the creators want to see.
Oh. Just kind of going on that, just on a humorous note, it's almost kind of like the cliche that, you know, men can only think about one thing at a time and women like multitask. That's kind of like genres. You know, if we take the idea that women are now majority of the readers, well, I mean, if we take that cliche, well, they want more stuff. They don't just want like just a straight science fiction. They want all this stuff together.
Right.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what most people. I mean, I would even think, you know, everybody kind of wants, you know, their cake and eat it too. I mean, I like you said, I mean, I was a big fan of the pulps, and the pulps were great adventure stories, but the women were always damsels in distress. which annoyed me to no end because I liked strong female characters, and I expected that and didn't get that. So there was a lot of, you know, you read all the man, you know, the boys' adventure stories, there was very few empowered women. And so, you know, and that's what women readers are looking for, not just for empowered women, but they want to be able to have a place within those stories that isn't, you know, back to old stereotypes.
Yeah, no, yeah, I definitely agree that there. And I think that's a good shift, that we're getting a lot more of that.
Because
it's been sorely missing. I'm getting kind of bored of, like, I love the Golden Age too, but, you know, you read these stories in which there's the damsel in distress, and she's just this really attractive lady with big breasts who just, help me! And, you know, the guy swoops in with the spaceship and saves her from the giant monster. It's like, yeah, that's fun for, like, five times in a row, but now I want, like, why doesn't it work the other way around? Like, he's the damsel in distress.
Exactly.
Anyway, yeah. I'm sorry, like, totally random. So one of the other questions, like, related to the alternate history, because one of the things we noticed was, you know, your book, the first book, Greyfire, is set in 2020, but the shift, the time shift of what this major event changes in which vampires come into the world is, I believe, 1870, which is a very interesting period, because that means that your entire change in your world has, like, skipped the modern period we're more familiar with. And I'm curious, what compelled you to choose that point in world history to have this shift?
There are two reasons. One, sort of theoretically, we felt that the late Victorian industrial period was a time where humanity was shifting away from the old ideas of faith and moving much stronger into the ideas of steam and steel solving all the issues of the world, where science and technology were going to fix all our problems, whereas prior to that, faith had been the primary the primary mechanism for understanding our world. Now, that's muddy, and 1870 is certainly not there's no great single event in 1870 that I would point to and say that's the moment when people suddenly became, you know, industrial and left religion behind. It's just that Victorian period symbolizes that. You don't want to necessarily push it too far, but it worked for us. The other element is we just like the Victorian era. When we conceived this story, we conceived it as a neo-Victorian world, and how do we arrange for that to happen? This was, frankly, before we were even familiar with the term steampunk. We had come up originally with the idea some decade or two ago. It took a long time to work through it and get it done, but we wanted a neo-Victorian fantasy world, an H.G. Wells, Jules Verne-y kind of world, and the alternate history trick is if vampires destroy the Northern Hemisphere in 1870, destroy the industrial world, and the humans flee to the equatorial tropical regions where vampires cannot follow because of the heat, and then the humans have to reconstruct their societies in those tropical regions, the mechanisms of production, that sounds very Marxist, but the mechanisms of production are going to be stunted because the Industrial Revolution was fueled by coal, and the vast majority of coal resources in the world are in the Northern Hemisphere. That's why Britain, Germany, Russia, the United States became industrial powers. We were sitting on coal. The vampires are now sitting on that coal and not using it, but they're depriving the humans from its use. That's why it took another 150 years with lesser economic resources to get back to a Victorian level of industrialization. That was a very long answer to your question. That's why we came up with this so-called steampunk world.
That was actually exactly the answer I was looking for.
Did we mention that Clay is actually a historian, and that's basically where that comes from? I mean, he thinks on a historical if side, so
well, I mean, you can tell we were just, you know, before we got you guys on, we were discussing, you know, it's like, okay, what happened in 1870? You know, it's in the United States, you've got Reconstruction going on, and you've got industrialization and whatnot, And one of the interesting facets about what's happening in the United States is that because it's Reconstruction, that's like the perfect time for vampires to come in and attack. You know, it's like the country is completely weakened by the Civil War, essentially got nothing. However, we were trying to figure out, well, when did they attack? Was it the beginning of 1870? Was it the end of 1870? Because that's, you know, definitely...
Late 1870, because the Franco-Prussian War was going on, and France was destroyed. In essence, France had been decapitated, and Germany was not yet a unified power, because it was really the Franco-Prussian War that created a unified Germany. So Europe was staggered by that event. Italy was not yet a unified power, and Britain was sort of off on its own watching what was happening to everyone else.
Told you, Jen.
That's what we realized, is that there had to be something going on that would have made it easy for the British to maintain control of places like Equatoria. I mean, they had kind of established their empire already around the same time. So it made sense for them to kind of take up the new reigns of empire.
Right, they just kind of came in and filled in their early colonial. The 1870 is pretty early in the colonial world, but they came and filled in, I mean, those who survived. And they brought their guns with them and their ships and, you know, whatever they had. But over the next century or two, they were forced, just by numbers, to blend into those societies that were already there. That it was not a colonial conquest. It was a bloody melting pot, in a way.
Right.
Book two deals with that a lot more. We deal with the Equatorian society, and we see how the local cultures, the Arab, the African cultures, blended with those northerners who sort of forced themselves desperately on those tropical people.
Right.
Yeah, it was hard to establish that in book one just because so much action, so much to get going with the two characters, and they went in different directions. But the book two will focus in on that element a little bit more, with Adela's rise in power to be the empress.
Right, and that's actually, I got to read the second book. Sean hasn't read it yet, but I liked the direction that you went with it in terms of focusing more on the internal dynamics of Equatoria and some of the external dynamics as well. But okay, so Senator Clark.
He's a jerk.
Gotta be one of the biggest douches in book history. But no, one of the most scathing indictments of American egoism in a modern fantasy novel that I've seen for a while. And one of my questions was, okay, so the alliance that, you know, you're setting up, potential alliance that you're setting up between the United States and Equatoria in that first book, it always seemed to me tenuous at best, due to how, you know, the American system of government works. You know, it's he's elected, presumably, versus obviously the dynasty, empire, and whatnot, royal family. What inspired this treatment of America and, you know, kind of American imperialism, because that's what he's come in to do, is kind of almost take over, versus your slightly more positive view of British imperialism.
Yeah. I'll answer this because Clark is kind of my guy.
I am absolved of all forms.
Nice.
I love Senator Clark.
I do too, actually.
He is the most fun to write of almost any character because he is that sort of pure American ego. We've taken some criticism from some readers who go, well, why are all the Americans jerks? Well, you really only see one American and maybe a little bit of his assistant, who's a nice guy.
Who's a nice guy, right.
Yeah. But Clark is from... he is my vision, I think, of how a lot of foreigners see a stereotypical American. He's big. He's loud. He's
flashy.
Sure of himself. And the trick is, when you're going into a war, which they are, he is the guy you want on your side because he knows how to fight a war, presumably, and he appears to be someone who's never going to die, no matter how many people around him are falling. His uniform never even gets dirty.
Right, which is great.
He's just that guy. He's you know, the Robert Apocalypse Now. What's the guy with the surfing?
Oh, I don't remember.
Can't think of his name. The helicopter.
Oh, with Robert Duvall's character.
Robert Duvall. He's that guy. He's never going to die. You know, that's what Martin Sheen's character was saying. You knew this guy was going to live. Everyone around him may die, but this guy's going to live. The American system in this book isn't quite as cut and dried. And since we haven't been to America, we haven't really seen it. But we briefly mentioned that it's really controlled by a small group of oligarchic rich families.
Right.
Perhaps not unlike the real America. So the elections are kind of, you know, they're formalities. He's not popularly elected. It's because he's from an important family that he's a senator. It's sort of like being an old Roman senator.
And he also he also won the first battle against the vampire. So that gave him a status of a vampire killer that no one else had achieved. And so he's banking on that fame, really.
Yeah,
we're
talking over each other.
That's fine.
He's the first and only war hero since the Great Killing. He's actually taken the fight to the vampires and defeated them. Now, of course, they lost that territory again the next winter. But that doesn't matter. He had the nerve to do it. And then in the first book, we see him accomplishing amazing acts of bravery or foolishness, but still accomplishing them. So he's a crowd pleaser. When you're in a time of doubt and instability, if you've got this guy on the white horse who comes riding in and says, "Follow me, I know what to do, I'll take care of you, it's going to be okay, and all you have to do is love me," well, people are going to love him. And that's kind of an American trait, I think. It's kind of an American feeling.
I think of him as like Teddy Roosevelt, like in The Wind and the Lion. I mean, he is a brash, he knows exactly what he wants to do, he knows exactly how to accomplish this thing, and as long as everybody else agrees with him, it's going to happen. And he becomes, I hated him in the first book, I hated writing him, I was always like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm writing this character. But by the second book, as annoying still as he is, he became someone fun, he became a character much more dynamic, much more intriguing. And somebody had suggested Nathan Fillion to act this character out, and I could see it so vividly in my head. And it's like, that's a brilliant bit of casting. So he has his elements. It's just, and it's not a statement of all Americans. It's a statement of one type of American. And you know, like you said, we have Stoddard, and he's another American, and he is the truer, the gentleman sense of you know, being that, you know, that of that. Of those Americas, and you know, he'll play into him a little bit too, and how that all comes. But you know, Clark is just so brash and so larger than life that he's so much fun to write just because of that.
And I think it's important to note too is like what Clay was saying at the very start was most of our focus characters in the first book they're not American. We do get a little bit of Clark, like some of his internal feelings or motivations, but pretty much the entire perspective is centered on a country that's not immediately connected to America. So that, in some sense, like, is a biased perspective that we're given.
Oh, for sure.
Exactly. I mean,
it's the filter of the, you know, Adela specifically, you know, is and Lord Kelvin. And they tend not to trust him in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, hence...
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. It's an outsider's view.
Right.
Look at 19th century British literature when they portray Americans. Look, if you've ever read Dracula, they have that one American character in there, Quincy. Now, is it Quincy? Now I'm not sure. He's like a cowboy.
Yeah.
He's from Texas. He's, you know, got guns strapped to his hip. He's kind of loud. He's kind of brash. That's the American, you know, stereotype from the culture Europeans of the period.
Makes sense.
It's awesome. Well, kind of related to this, well, not maybe not so related to it, but it was a question Jen came up with, and she stole it from me. She's a jerk.
Do you want me to ask it?
No. I'm okay, asking. It's okay. My question.
Go for it.
So one of the things is that throughout this story, we get this impression that there is magic in this world, and that there are these there are the different like quote unquote magic characters who are all like the other. I mean, you have Mamoru, who is Japanese. You have, and I'm going to butcher these names, Nzingu, who's Zulu, Sana, who's Persian, and there's other characters, and who are all are kind of ostracized in society because this is in Equatoria. It's all about like the science and all the like the religion and the magic. That's all superstition, and it's kind of people roll their eyes at it. And so I thought it was really interesting that this was something that was present in this. And Jen asked it in this way. She said, like, how much of this analysis is me reading too much into the books, and how much of it is you setting the series up for an unexpected resolution?
Well, because to me, it's more so in the second book. You definitely, the cultural war that's taking place within Equatoria is almost more threatening than the vampire war. That is kind of on the fringes. It comes home to them, but it's still something that's kind of at a distance from the empire itself. So, again,
I think that's a very interesting perspective, because, in fact, one of the themes is, and there are certain characters who have knowledge of this theme, Kelvin is one of them, which is we are not prepared to fight this war against the vampires because we don't have our house in order yet. We've got too many problems down here among the humans, and if we go to fight this war, it's going to expose those cracks in our societies, and we're going to fly apart. And that's Kelvin's whole point of view in both books.
And basically, I mean, magic is looked down upon as magic in this faith because it didn't save anybody. You know, it didn't save them from the vampires. And so it's sort of been shoved aside and looked down as being something quaint versus being something that's, you know, that we're going to, you know, keep up and it's going to save us. That's all gone now. And basically they all believe that technology is going to save them. So that aspect of, you know, people like Mamoru, and you've got all the other names correct, by the way, very impressive, except for Mamoru's. But Mamoru, you know, he believes so strongly that this is still the way to beat the vampires, but he's just so beaten down because everybody else in government has turned away from that and still believe that, you know, blood and steel is what's gonna win the day. And so you have that difference between fighting the vampires and with the steel, and yet the aspect that there is some other method boiling below the surface. Both literally and figuratively, that that the people who are non-technocrats want to bring to the forefront. But how do you get past all that prejudice? How do you get past all that past history where it didn't save anybody? And so, yeah, you have those two differences going on at the same time, so which will all come to a conclusion, hopefully, within the third book if we can orchestrate this properly.
And it seems like also it's, you know, that some of that extends from those sort of 1800s sensibilities about, you know, what are the proper cultures and what are the proper groups of people. I mean, more particularly like a European view of those things, which I think is interesting that you've, you know, because we've talked earlier about how like human society gets like crushed down and like has to spend 100 years trying to get back to like Victorian technology era, and at the same time we still have these kinds of old ideologies which have never shifted, or shifted somewhat, but they're still kind of there. So
yeah, that's true. I mean, in the Victorian era, obviously people practiced religion, but it was a fairly sedate, and again this is from a British, primarily British point of view, a fairly sedate practice. Those who were ecstatic in their religious practice were thought of as pretty fringy types and on the verge of being occultists or magicians. So, and that's what we're trying to bring to this, is that magic and religion are kind of lumped together, and they're not outlawed. It's not, the cops aren't hunting down priests or imams or rabbis or magicians. They're not hunting them down, but if you want to get anywhere in that society, in the Equatorian society, if you want to go to the best schools, if you want to get a government position, if you want to be a university professor, you don't participate, at least not openly and at least not in a fervent manner.
But look at it in terms of the Victorian sensibilities of spiritualism. You know, there were all those people like Houdini who were going about to debunk the spiritualist movement. So it's that kind of concept, basically, also that, you know, it's still frowned upon, that it's, you know, it's not really going to hold together. So it's just coming from that, exactly that same period as well.
Gotcha.
Interesting.
So quick questions on the vampires. I love them.
Because they're not sparkly.
They're not sparkly. Your vampires are, they're absolutely brutal. They're almost scientifically based, which was a nice element. They're maniacal, and they're also completely wallowing in their power. I mean, they're gluttons to the nth degree. And again, it's probably me reading way too much into this, but this, again, seemed like a nice critique of empire. And, you know, because they're content in their power up there for the most part.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we love playing the two empires against each other. There's elements in the vampire area that's just a fun bit to play with. I mean, they are excessive. They've gone to the point where they're sitting pretty. They have very few natural enemies, and they're kind of glorifying in it. And there's that disdain that Gareth has for the way his people have become so decadent, and which is, you know, almost to the looking into our society too, that we've become to the point where we're overachievers, basically, and we're not really, vampires in our world don't create anything. They just live on the ruins, but they do it magnificently, and, you know, they reap everything that they can get their hands on and take it, but they're certainly not going to contribute to society. They're just going to be there and controlling it, and we love playing with that aspect of them.
Oh, yeah. It was a nice, not just of empire, but of wealth. Yeah.
Yeah, they absorb the aspects of the
Paris
Hilton people.
They
dress nice. Well, they don't all dress nice, but they like to dress nice. They like to live inside. They don't want to hunt anymore. You know, they've just become this sort of these slobs. But they're so contemptuous of humanity, and yet they're slowly almost like becoming humans. It's that's a strong theme that'll carry on through the trilogy.
So I kind of bogarted all the questions today, but from Sean. So sorry, Sean. One of the things that I really liked about Adela is that she kind of embodies a sort of egalitarian spirit. I mean, yes, she's destined to become the Empress, but she definitely has inconvenient ideas about things, at least according to Lord Kelvin. Do you think this is just something that makes steampunk so alluring, or do you think it's just the clothes and the dirigibles?
Yeah.
I'd like to think it's both.
Yeah, I mean, I, in terms of steampunk, yeah, I think it is both, because steampunk allows you to play with history, twist it both technologically to where you get cool-looking stuff, and twist it socially, as we were talking about, sort of putting women into old style adventure stories. By putting women into old style adventure stories, putting them in a role that they never would have, you know, you look at like an Arthur Conan Doyle adventure story, like The Lost World, there are no women in there. There, I think, one, and she briefly appears at the beginning and at the end, and she ends up being a jerk. It's a man's world when you go off to fight dinosaurs or whatever. But steampunk allows that to change and allows women and other cultures from around the world and other races and other classes and all kinds of things to participate in this rich imperial culture that people love, because it's an expression of power and creativity. But now everyone's a part of it, not just the few upper crust, you know, white guys who sit in the gentleman's club. Now everyone can dress cool and have cool guns and goggles and ride on an airship. So, yeah, I think steampunk has that egalitarian element, which is draws a lot of people to it.
Yeah, I hated it when Professor Challenger put his wife up on that pedestal. I mean, here she was a great character in that book, and he just put her on a pedestal and forgot about her. And I'm like, why? She's like one of the best characters and completely walked away. Again, it's just one of those things that annoy me about the old adventure style stories, that women just don't get have that ability to be involved in the story making. And Adela is that sensibility turned on its ear, basically.
But one of the nice things about the Vampire Empire is that you're touching on the contention between, the egalitarian versus the imperial, as opposed to just ignoring it and going, well, steampunk is egalitarian, so we're just going to go with that direction. You actually have the fight going on between the two sides, which was...
Oh, yeah, well, because it wasn't a steampunk book to begin with.
Yeah.
It was a neo-Victorian fantasy, whatever that means. And right. So we had to show how they're living with some Victorian sensibilities, but obviously if that was the case, Adela would sit in a chair all day and never go anywhere, and
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't be a very exciting adventure novel. So she has to be active, she has to be able to fight with a sword and a gun, but to connect it to that real Victorian world, that real world, so that the reader can be grounded, so it's not just a science fiction novel, they have to be grounded in the real earth, the real world. You've got to explain why are these changes happening. And yes, there are people who are against that. They're against women being on the throne. They're against women being a war leader. In that way, oddly, the vampires are much more, totally more egalitarian. Flay is the greatest of the vampire war chiefs and female, and no one looks cross-eyed at her. She is what she is, and she could easily kill anyone who stood in her way.
Jen, you have a totally silly question you want to ask them.
Oh, good.
I actually have two silly questions.
Okay, go for it. Two.
And I'm gonna run them out really quickly. One, what's with the cats? And two, how the hell did you get James Marsters to do the voice for the audiobook? And is he as sexy as I think he is?
Which one do you want, Sue?
That's all actually right. Three questions.
I'll take James Marsters. It would just be odd for you to talk about it. So you talk about the cats.
Okay. James Marsters, the cats, we're both cat likers. I guess we're cat lovers. We have a cat. And we thought it would be interesting to have this vampire who lives alone, basically, surrounded by these cats who typically animals are not fond of vampires, but these cats seem to like him. So it gives this interesting juxtaposition of this aloof character who seems to be interested in these animals for reasons that he can't quite figure out. Plus, cats are just popular. People like them. So it's not a bad thing to have cats in the book. People enjoy books with cats in them, and we like writing about cats. So
I love cats.
Yeah, and we thought, what happens to all the animals after the great killing? Yeah, these are all stray cats that, you look at those islands where the cats just roam free, and it sort of just came organic out of that, here's all these animals, and, what's a cool place to hang out? The highest peak, cats like, heights, so there they are hanging out at, Edinburgh Castle, overlooking the city. I'm sure, they're all over the place, but then he's got a bunch of them working around the castle was just a great idea. In regards to James Marsters, it was fortuitous beyond measure, and we still really kind of have to pinch ourselves to even comprehend that what great fortune we've had with that. It turned out that how it happened was that Buzzy Media approached us for the audiobook, and they had had great success with the Dresden series, and James Marsters had done that one too, plus a couple other series where they had gotten some people from True Blood, and they won the contract for the audiobook, and we really didn't think much about who they could get. We figured Marsters was doing the Dresden books and he was kind of unavailable, so we were just waiting, and when they made the announcement, I think we all kind of just hit the floor, and we really were thrilled. For him to have taken another vampire project after all these years, after Buffy, and it be our book was such validation and just thrill that we are so happy with that. And he is that gorgeous person. And very hard sitting next to him because it was very distracting.
Can I touch you? Right.
Oh. seriously, I couldn't.
I thought he was pretty sexy too, actually.
Oh, well, that's good.
I'll give it to you. He's in Torchwood, and he's pretty hot in Torchwood.
He was a genuinely nice man. We met him, what you referred to. He did a live reading of the first chapter of The Grey Friar at Dragon Con in Atlanta this past Labor Day, and we were there with him. He was great. He read amazingly well. He was conversant with the book. It's not like he just walked in. It's the first time he'd ever seen it. He was conversant with the characters. He had questions about it. It was thrilling that he was so into it and so interested in it and loved the book, and we gave him the second one for him to read on the plane home. So
yeah,
he's going to do the entire trilogy.
Yeah, he's Shakespearean trained. He was able to do the voices and all the different accents. It was above and beyond anything we could have imagined. He made that book come alive, even for us. We were sitting there just listening, and Alec has kept going. I just kept getting chills just because it's like, wow, that sounds really like a great story and a great, you know, bunch of characters. And it was great to see him bring it to life as well as he did. He was exceptional.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool.
You might actually get me to listen to an audiobook. I don't normally, but if it's James Marsters, I am so there.
I'm not a big audiobook person either, but the best audiobooks are when they have the high production values, when they do things like the voices and they try to, those are the best.
Yeah, we're going to try and get a couple of snippets of it up online, either on our blog or on Pyre's blog, and probably Buzzy will probably be doing the same thing. So hopefully there'll be some samples. You guys can get a little taste of what it's of his skills. And just to hear him speak. So we'll try and get that up hopefully within the next couple of weeks.
Wow, that's awesome. Cool. All right.
Last question. Yeah, well, we're getting, like I said before we started this, we're running out of time. So just like the big sort of before we go here, what can we expect from you both in the future? And of course, where can people find you?
But in terms of the future, we'll have book three. We're just in the process of finishing up the last few chapters, and then we'll be going through the editing process. So probably about a year from now, there'll probably be another reveal at Dragon Con for book three. And once we have that in the can, we're hoping to continue with the series. We're not sure what the future of it is. And hopefully if, you know, people love it and the outcry is there, you know, we'll continue to play, because there's so much in the world that we haven't been able to touch on, like the Americas and you know, the Asian continents, all that. We would love to dive into more of the you know, focus for the readers. We do dabble in comic books still. We have a couple. I think Alan Quatermain and The Lord of Locusts is going to be coming out from Blue Water. We're not quite sure when, but it's been coming out as a graphic novel. So we've got, you know, still a couple of other things going on, but you can find us. I'll let Clay say where we can be found, since hopefully he knows these things by heart.
Oh, yeah. You wish. Where can we be found? We have a Facebook, Vampire Empire Facebook. It's like www.facebook.com/Vampire Empire. We each have individual Facebook pages, Clay Griffith, Susan Griffith, but the Vampire Empire page is where you get all the info. We also have a blog on Blogspot, which is just Clay and Susan Griffith. I don't know the exact. Just, you can Google Clay and Susan Griffith blog, and we come up.
I think it's clayandsusan.blog.com.
Yeah. We, in terms of appearances, we actually have a signing tomorrow night. I'm not sure when this is airing, but we'll have a signing on September 15th at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, North Carolina. 7:30. We have several events in New York City coming up in early October. Oh, I want to say October 3rd, we have a reading at a steampunk Doctor Who bar in Brooklyn. That's going to be awesome, called The Way Station. Then we are appearing for the New York Science Fiction Review of Books on October 4th at the Soho Gallery of Digital Arts. All this stuff will be on Facebook and our blog, so you'll be able to track us down there. So a couple of appearances. Beyond that, I don't know if we have anything scheduled after that, but I'm sure we'll find something.
Yeah, I think we also have an interview with the Hour of the Wolf radio show in New York with Jim Freund. It airs at like 1:30 a.m., but it is a call-in show, so if you're awake, feel free to call in with questions.
That'd be great.
And you can download the episodes for that, so.
Yeah, you can.
That'll be great. Awesome. Because the episode's not supposed to go up till Monday. We release on Monday, but I will make sure that we'll post something on the blog and on Twitter to make sure that people know that you guys are going to be at Quail Ridge. So thank you guys very much for being here. Susan, of course, having coughing, so she'll sound a little off. But thank you guys for being here and coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
As I said off air, your questions were great and very perceptive and make us think that there's a lot of depth to the book, which sometimes it gets a lot of reviews as a sort of a thrilling adventure story, which it is. But as a historian, I had hoped that we'd put in some layers in the world and layers in the characters. And your questions give me hope that those layers are in fact there.
They are
exactly.
There. And very much appreciated. So.
Well, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
No problem.
Yes, thank you, guys. All right.
So if anybody wants to send us hate mail, which occasionally happens. Not really. It never happens.
Not really.
Mm-hmm. I wish we got hate mail.
I can send you some hate mail if you wish.
Yay!
That would be wonderful. So you can that in four ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
Twitter message.
Twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And you can just leave a comment on the blog somewhere.
SkiffyandFanty.wordpress.com. And we actually also have a Facebook page, which we have never mentioned before, but we do have one.
Okay, we have a Facebook page. We'll make sure there's links. But we'll also make sure there's links to everything for Susan and Clay, for their books, for their websites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that will go up with the episode. So thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Well, all right. Have a good one. See you next week, folks.
Bye.
Caution. You have entered the pod destruction zone. Please secure all podcatchers. Caution.
How's it coming, guys?
You have entered
this won't go any faster if you keep interrupting.
Got it. Here's some steampunk, diesel punk, gothic punk.
Goth punk?
Gothic. Trust me on this.
Hey, you're the one who invited him to the show, Sean. I've got epic fantasy, sword and sorcery, and all the news on ebooks.
That's it! Check it out! Clock pump! Ooh, shiny.
I have space opera, time travel, Stargate, and...
Sean, is that He-Man?
Shut up. Boys, I think we did it.
A superior podcast.
Publishing, writing, genre, best-selling authors, and the hot new writers of today.
Editors and agents, contests? Did we leave anything out?
AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com.
Subscribe today to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature since 2006.
Sean?
It's just so beautiful.
Podstruction complete. Enjoy.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.